This audio file is a production of the University of Chicago Law School. Visit us on the web at www.law.uchicago.edu.
Thank you, Tariel and Omri, for having me, and thank you for Omri for inviting me to think about and write about this with him. So, I think he's already told you where to locate this paper, so I'll just start with some motivation of how we came about thinking about this. So our motivation for writing about this comes from juxtaposing two opposite views about the role of fault in contracts. So the first view is that fault is irrelevant, this is Holmes, and this is sufficient breach theory, and we all know about that. The second view is that fault is very relevant for contract damages, and Jacob and Young has already featured prominently today. This is one of our favorite quotes. The willful transgressor must accept the penalty of his transgression. For him, there is no occasion to mitigate the rigor of implied conditions. The transgressor, whose default is unintentional and trivial, may hope for mercy if he will offer atonement for his wrong. Okay, so fault plays a big role, and just another example is section 39 of the proposed restatement of restitution, again, emphasizing the role of intentionality. Or willfulness of the breach. So this leads us to the following questions. So first, on the positive side, does fault play a role in contract? Specifically, we're focusing on remedies. On the normative side, should it play a role, and if so, why? And of course, the background of all of this, and again, harking back to Dick's presentation, what do we mean when we're talking about fault? And Dick was, of course, correct in his characterization of what we will be meaning by fault, a certain tag attached to something, but we hope that it's not just a tag, and I'll get back to that. So now, starting to answering these questions, the answer to the first question is easy. Well, yes, fault plays a role in the doctrine, and we can argue about how large these pockets are and whether they're swallowing the whole or not, but it definitely plays a role. So we're going to focus on the normative question of why does fault matter? And the traditional explanation, we read it, is a sanctity of contract, sanctity of promise explanation. But the problem with this traditional explanation, it's not clear of what exactly is this promise that we're sanctifying. And this is the familiar problem that contracts are incomplete, and in particular, they're incomplete with respect to damages. So we find this traditional explanation somehow wanting, and we move on to propose an alternative. And our alternative is an information-based explanation, which goes something like this. So the first distinction that we draw is between two types of breaches. So there are standalone breaches, and then there are breaches that are part of a pattern. And the argument is that when we have a pattern of breaches, this pattern is often held together by something. This something is either a bad type, bad promissor type, or some low ex ante investment taken by the promissor. And when we have this pattern that is tied together by these ex ante behaviors or type, then when we observe a breach that is part of this pattern, we can infer something, we can learn something. In statistical terms, we can update our prior about the likelihood that this breach, that this breaching promissor is a bad type or chose an inadequately low level of investment. The other component of the theory, this is a theory we call that wants to justify supercompensatory damages, is that when we have this pattern of breaches and we identify one, and we learn from this one identified breach that there is a low ex ante investment or a bad type, and also, and therefore there are probably other breaches, the other component is that some of these other breaches might be either undetected or imperfectly enforced in some way. And if they are, then we can punish, or we can compensate, put it differently, we can compensate for the imperfect enforcement of these other breaches. It could be of a very different kind than the one that we are now detecting and punishing. we can compensate for that imperfect enforcement by increasing damages on the breach that we are detecting and observing. So it's basically a substitution argument. What I want to emphasize, though, is when we're looking at these breaches as part of a pattern, what comes out of this is that we need not attach any specific blameworthiness to the breach, to this detected, observed breach that we are now punishing more severely. That is not the reason for the supercompensatory damages. The fault is located at the ex ante stage. The fault is the fact that we now have a larger likelihood that this is a bad type, or there was a low ex ante investment. And for this, this is the true reason for punishing. Now, as we were writing this, we came across the following newspaper article about overbooked flights. So a common sentiment that is reported in this article is that overbooking is a conscious fraud, and that the seller has sold a contract knowing that it might not honor that contract. The article continues to quote a passenger saying, if flights are being overbooked, then what does that say about how the airline runs their business? Now, we don't want to read too much into this, but I think it does demonstrate that when people are, lay people, trying to assess the blameworthiness of a breach, this notion of a pattern of something that's deeper underlying this breach and perhaps connecting it to other breaches is something that people think about. Okay, so in the paper we try to flesh out these ideas through a very simple numeric example. What I plan to do in the next few minutes is just give you an abstract overview of this example. So we're imagining a promisor that ex post can choose between different levels or qualities of performance. In particular, the choices between standard performance, mediocre performance, and terrible performance. Standard performance provides a certain value to the promisee. 50 in our example, mediocre performance provides a lower value, 40, and terrible performance provides no value whatsoever. Now, the important component, as I've already alluded to, is that, at least one of the important components, is that we have some kind of imperfect enforcement or imperfect verification in this example. And the idea here is that while courts can always, with 100% certainty, identify and punish terrible breaches or terrible performance, courts may not be able to identify or verify mediocre as compared to standard performance. Now, as I said, the promisor in our example chooses, this is deliberate if we know what that means, chooses between standard, mediocre, and terrible. So this is a choice that the promisor makes. And this choice, this ex post choice, will depend on the cost, the ex post cost of these different levels of performance. Now this cost will depend, of course, on the quality chosen. Standard will be more costly than mediocre more costly than terrible. It will also depend, it also depends in our example, on some random event, the realization of a state of nature, which can be either bad or good, or a simplified example. So if the state of nature is good, performance on quality, on different qualities is lower. If the state of nature is bad, then performance is more costly. Finally, and most importantly for present purposes, the cost of these performances, these three levels of performance, depends on some ex ante investment that the promisor chose. Now here, just to keep things simple, we assume that there is either a high level of this investment or a low level of this investment. Investing low means not investing at all. Investing high has a certain cost. Now we choose the numbers in our example such that the first best, what we actually want to happen, will be H. So we want, it is efficient for the promisor to choose a high level of investment because the expected reduction in these ex post performance costs is greater than the ex-ante cost of investing H. Now we start to examine the different remedy regimes. Okay, so if we start with standard expectation damages, compensatory damages, if we have perfect verification, if the courts can identify both M and T and distinguish them from standard performance, then we have the standard result that the first best is achieved, and we get first the optimal choice ex post and the optimal choice ex ante. Things are starting to become a little bit more interesting when we have imperfect verification. When courts, and specifically when courts cannot distinguish and therefore cannot punish for mediocre performance. In this case, the incentive to choose H are reduced. In our example, the promisor will choose L rather than H, and we get this inefficiency. Now, the intuition here is that the cost of choosing L with imperfect verification has gone down. Because now, when I choose L, I, the promisor, choose L, I will want X post to go for M rather than S. Now, with perfect verification, I would be punished for this. Damages would be imposed. Now that they are not imposed, the cost of choosing L goes down, and therefore I will be more likely to choose this inefficient ex ante level of investment. And finally, the proposed solution here is to impose super compensatory damages, to impose high damages. And we show that by doing this, we can restore efficiency and lead the promisor to choose H at the ex ante stage. But the important point, this is what this example is designed to flush out, is that these super compensatory damages that we're now imposing are being imposed on the breach that the court can identify, on the T breach, on the terrible quality. Of course, that's the only thing that the court can punish. The interesting feature here is that by increasing damages for T breach, we can induce or we can substitute for our inability to punish the M breaches. Okay, so again, just to reiterate the information-based nature of this argument, when we observe the T breach, we learn something about the investment chosen by the promisor. In this case, we learn by observing the T breach that the promisor chose a low level of investment. Now we know that this promisor would also choose M, the M that we cannot detect. And we are punishing him for this M that we cannot detect by increasing the sanction on the T that we are detecting. Okay, so this was a very kind of brief exposition to our very simple example. And this, as you've seen, is a moral hazard example. It's an example that is based on this ex ante investment, which provides the link between the different parts of the different breaches in our pattern of breaches. We also discussed briefly an alternative interpretation here, and this is an adverse selection as opposed to a moral hazard interpretation. And this is the case where the common force tying the different breaches in the pattern is not an ex-ante investment, but rather is a certain a type of breacher. So we're envisioning we have a high integrity type of promisor and a low integrity type of promisor. And the low integrity type is going to breach in instances where the high integrity promisor would not breach. And again, by observing a breach, we learn something. The information-based component here, we learn something about, here, not about the investment, but about the type of the promisor. And again, we are, by increasing damages in this case, we are compensating for those other breaches that we now expect that this bad type has already performed and have gone undetected or unpunished or will perform. Interestingly, when we're talking about high damages in this context, they can serve two different roles. So one role might be to induce a separating equilibrium by allowing the high integrity promisor to signal her type. Notice that for the high integrity promisor, the promisor who is not going to breach, it is costless to undertake these high damages. But these high damages can also be desirable or adopted by the low integrity promisor who wants to commit not to committing these breaches. Okay, so this is the theory. We try to go over three doctrines or categories of cases where we think this theory can potentially explain what we see. Now, the first of these is the tort damages for bad faith breach. Now, these are tort damages, classified as tort damages, in order to avoid the no penalty rule in contract law, but we're talking clearly about contracts, and the main example here is the insurance contract example. So if we look at the leading case of State Farm versus Campbell, the Utah Supreme Court, when describing the case, identifies the main components that our theory also relies upon. Okay, so first of all, the court emphasizes that the breach was part of a pattern that results from the insurer's ex-ante choice of a low integrity practice or policy. These are more or less the words that the court uses. And the court also puts its finger on the other necessary component in our discussion, namely that many of these breaches, the other breaches, go undetected. Now, I should say that the U.S. Supreme Court rejected this pattern theory. But actually, I want to bring this quote just to emphasize a certain characteristic here, which is, I think, interesting and distinguishes our theory from other imperfect enforcement arguments in the literature. So what troubled the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, was that there was no relationship between one breach, the detected breach, the litigated breach, and those other breaches. And in fact, the standard theories talk about multiplying damages or increasing damages for the same category of breach. The idea behind our theory is that we can, or we should, increase damages for one breach to compensate for imperfect enforcement on breaches from potentially very different categories. Okay, so the U.S. Supreme Court rejected this pattern theory in State Farm versus Campbell, but still it does, it continues to pervade an insurance doctrine. The second category of cases that I want to talk about involves contracts, like construction contracts, contracts that specify multiple obligations. Now, if we think that a breach of one of these obligations is due to a low quality control or a general laxity in attention to contractual detail, then we have this underlying common factor that links the identified breach, one specification in this contract, with potentially unidentified breaches in this pattern. And again, these breaches can be very different. They can involve very different specifications in this same contract. So going back once again to Jacob and Young's, what we would have liked Cardozo to ask when discussing the reading pipe breach is whether this breach is possibly part of a pattern, whether there is some underlying laxity in quality control or attention to the details of the contract that suggests to us that regardless of how harmful this breach was, there might be other breaches that go unpunished that we may want to substitute punishment for in this instance or in this opportunity that we have. I should also mention that the Jacob and Young's is usually not taken, we're focusing here on damages, super compensatory damages. This is not interpreted as a super compensatory damages case. Rather, this is a case about how to measure compensatory damages, diminution in value measure versus cost of completion measure. What we're proposing here is that if we take think the diminution in value is the right compensatory amount, there may be a justification to go higher than that. We can call it cost of completion damages. And finally, let me just briefly mention restitution law. I mentioned Section 39 of the third post-third restatement, which seems to provide a very broad base for supercompensatory disgorgement damages for intentional breach. Now, as should be clear by now, our theory does not provide a very broad justification for supercompensatory damages in this context. And again, to the extent that Section 39 would be interpreted narrowly according to our theory, we would be, of course, thrilled. So let me conclude briefly. So we started with a tension between Holmes and efficient breach and this very strong intuition that willful breach justifies supercompensatory damages. We think that part of the reason for this tension is the focus on a single ex post breach decision. So when instead we look at a pattern of breaches and we look at an ex ante decision or type that ties them together, then supercompensatory damages are both efficient and I think they comport with our intuition about fault, here understood in this ex ante sense. And finally, again, to emphasize going back to Dick's point, we don't use willful in any sense that's related to a mental state. We use it as a tag for these types of breaches that we want to, or these type of context where we think supercompensatory damages are efficient. But I think it's important that this tag is attached to this idea of a pattern with an underlying bad type or bad behavior, which comports with our intuition about what types of breaches are more blameworthy than others. And finally, I don't know how I'm with the time, but just one final minute. I know you're supposed to do literature at the beginning, but I thought it would be more efficient to do this at the end where you have an idea of what we're actually proposing. So of course, these arguments are related to the standard literature on punitive damages and supercompensatory damages. But the distinction, I think it's an important one, is that in this literature, supercompensatory damages focus on the imperfect detection of the detected breach. So ex ante, the breaching party did not know, or underthought, or knew actually, that the detection would be of a low probability or lower than 100%. On the other hand, we emphasize the imperfect detection of other, possibly very different, types of breaches. And by doing this, or as we do this, we emphasize the information-based feature here. So we can learn from one breach about other very different breaches, which is not a component of the same. Sean. Let me try to do this, and maybe Omri can chip in if I'm not right on the point. So following Dick's distinction, we are here working under the assumption, under the inadequate damages model. So we're thinking that for various reasons it might be difficult to identify the low or inadequate ex-ante investment. I actually prefer to talk about the investment rather than the kind of bad types, partly for the reasons that you've mentioned. So we use the breach. It could be, by the way, and I'm not ruling that out, that if we could identify and verify the ex-ante level of investment, we would want to police that directly. Okay, and if we could, then it would be less important to focus on the breach, the ex-post breach, to define it as the ex-post choice, say in the level, to the quality of the performance. But if we can't, then we use the breach, this is what we observe. So we use that as the trigger to provide the incentives that we want to provide. Now, going on to the second part of your question, why don't we or what should we? So this is basically a story about what parties would have wanted. Okay? So we are trying to track the ex-ante intentions of the parties and what they would have wanted. And it's sufficient in this very kind of, I think, weak sense, or very strong sense, depends on how you look at it. They would have wanted higher damages for detected breaches because, for example, they think that it would be costly for us or impossible to ask the court to verify all possible breaches, or we know that the court will not be able to verify. So we want this larger stick on the breaches that can be identified. That's what the parties want. That's the normative criteria, if there is one.
I get the point of the overcompensation. Let me just rephrase the question in one way. Suppose that it's the case that certain kinds of bargaining behaviors are associated with a type of person who underinvests. So let's, right? But okay. It's in the bargaining that these character traits are revealed.
Okay.
If I could show a pattern that this kind of person who bargains in this nickel and dime way is likely to engage in underinvestment in the performance of a contract, but I can identify no breach, should I be able to collect damages nonetheless on the grounds that this is a type of person, that the type of person has been revealed by the bargaining behavior associated with a pattern of underinvestment, and hence there's a likelihood of the underdetection breaches?
So I'm trying to understand. So I am bargaining with this person, right, who's revealing himself through his bargaining tactics as a bad type. So I can choose not to contract with this person, or I can take precautions if I choose to contract with him. Why would I resort to remedies? At what stage would I, now in the middle of the bargaining process, I'm now suing him for?
Well, I suppose I have to make a contract him in a hurry. I got to make a contract as the person who wants to buy it. But
and I cannot protect myself against that.
Yeah,
so I make the contract, and after I'm done, I sue him for the yet unmaterialized breaches that I know that he will make. Is that the argument?
You're assuming that a type of behavior is associated with undetectable breach. Why does it make a difference whether or not
I like your comment because I think you're arguing that we are proving too much in a sense. There are many other things where you can say people have done something that is not so nice, and from this we infer realistically that they've done other things not so nice, so let's now go and punish them for all these things. And you're right, we don't have a criterion for excluding, you know, saying why our the principle we're talking about applies here, but not generally. If someone is abusive in a domestic setting, that teaches us something, maybe how they behave also in contracts, you know. So let's tack on in a little, you know, increment to the punishment for because of all the information that we are inferring regarding the other domain. We don't, and maybe it's something we need to think about, is to find a way to restrict the domain of this explanation and say, it's interesting that it applies here, it might apply here, we are not yet proposing to a kind of apply it universally.
So just one quick follow-up. I think that one criterion, if I really need to think more about this, but the criterion that I would at least start with, and it was the first part of my answer to you, is we're talking about contracts, not about fixing the world. So the normative criteria that I would like to start with is what would the parties have wanted had they contracted about this explicitly, and they would probably not want to deal now in their contracts with, you know, tax avoidance. Eric.
I have two questions. The first is really just, it wasn't clear to me what the rule was that you were advocating. Is it that super compensatory damages should be awarded in when the terrible outcome occurs, or always, or when these information conditions are satisfied and not otherwise implicit?
No. So the test would be, so the question we would want the court to ask is whether this is a standalone breach, the one that you're now observing, whether you think this is a standalone breach, or whether it is likely part of a pattern that is tied together by something that can be affected.
But what's that based on? You don't observe any of the other breaches, my hypothesis. So what do you, and you don't observe the investment. So what do you look at in order to determine whether there's a pattern?
So for example, there could be a contract that says, like in PV House, it's in terms of the obligations is, you know, one shot, you need to level the land. There could be another contract that has a series of, you know, 50 different obligations. Now, courts can make an inference about whether there is something that connects your likely performance of these different obligations, especially if there's one obligation in the contract.
But there's just one event, right?
There's one event.
So
one observed event, yes.
So why, I don't understand. So if there's only one obligation and you don't do, so I'm supposed to deliver some commodity to you and I just don't do it.
Right.
And that's it. Yeah, I just
wouldn't apply. It wouldn't apply.
I don't have to pay super compensatory
no.
damages. But if we have a contract in which I'm supposed to do something on day one, which you can't observe, is that it? And then on day two, I'm supposed to deliver and I don't deliver. Then I pay super compensatory damages.
Right, if there's something that you were supposed to do on day one is also performance to me, not some, you know,
yeah,
yes.
But you can't
yeah.
observe it.
Yes, then yes. If again, if we think...
What would that mean? I don't understand.
Jacobs and Young is the standard.
You're building the house, and it turns out at the end that, I mean, there's no pattern here because you don't have anything else to... The only difference between the house and the thing I delivered you. So I delivered you a commodity. It's not as complicated as a house. But you only observe one thing that's wrong with it,
So you're saying there's a warranty about
it. Two situations then. One is I simply don't deliver it to you. I just pay compensatory damages. That's the end of the story. The other case is, you know, let's say it's a toaster, and you notice that the knob is kind of loose. Now I pay super compensatory damages because it's also possible that the heating coil, you know, takes too long to warm up. Is that what
yes.
it would mean?
That would be the analogy. Although
that's not what's going on in any of these cases, is it?
No, so this would be very similar to our interpretation, I think, of the Jacob and Young case. So we think, so the interpretation would be, and I'm not sure that this actually nets out in the facts of the case, but one interpretation would be, so we don't have reading pipe, we have another kind of pipe. What other non-adherence to specification are there in my house?
I think the court is far more likely to award super compensatory damages if the contractor just says, forget it, I don't want to build this building at all. And doesn't tell you, then if he builds the building and he gets one thing wrong, in fact, it sounds like the opposite. He gets one thing wrong, but all these other things that he could have gotten wrong as well. Why shouldn't there be super compensatory damage in Jacob and Young's?
The argument is that there could be, there is a good reason to award super compensatory damages in Jacob and Young because there were other things that
so
could have gone wrong.
No. If there was, I think it depends what the inquiry that wasn't made, what would be the consequence. If, say, distinguish two case situations, one in which the contractor deliberately chooses to put in the Cobos pipe, and the other in which it was a mistake, what we would suggest is that the first incident would teach us that a party that does something like this, we tell ourselves, huh, what else did they try to do? And when we turned our head and didn't see what they were doing,
So you are fine. It's the mental state idea.
Sure, it's not agnostic to the mental state, but the mental state matters. Not because there's some kind of, you know, enhanced agency or something. You know, I'm not even sure how to justify the mens rea kind of the severity of the mens rea, but because it indicates that there must be some kind of better party that does something like this doesn't do it as an isolated.
I just don't understand.
No, wait. So let me just.
You have a complicated performance with lots of obligations which can't be observed, and you have a simple performance. That's the distinction there.
Right.
And you're only willing to award super compensatory damages in a complicated performance.
That's right.
Now you're making another distinction, which is whether the breach that was observed was actually intended or whether it was inadvertent.
In the context in which there is a whole mesh of things that we, that can go, a whole pattern of obligations, that could, yes, that...
So I'm not sure whether we need that, though. I mean, it could, I mean, if you think
so
about it.
What's the test?
So, again, I would do it simpler. I would just go by the outcome. So if there is an outcome, we identify that there is specification X, you did not meet it. Now, if we think that there are another X, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 specification in this contract, and there is something that would lead us to believe that...
Well, what's that something? Because I can't believe that you think that whenever there's a complicated performance, there should be super compensatory damages.
No, but
think there's something else that would lead us to infer...
Right, so this is Jacob and Young. So we think of it, you know, people have been discussing this, right? They've been talking about the ex ante investment. Was there care taken to make sure that it wasn't, that we meet specifications? So these are ongoing. But let me move on to that. I'm ignoring Richard.
I think there might be an instance in which the contractor takes overly expensive precautions against breach. You know, I could imagine, you know, in the modern day, the contractor takes the security camera that he keeps on the site all night long to guard against thieves and turns it on the house so that if there is, if it's later discovered that he didn't use the reading wipes, he can at least defend himself against charges that he had 17 other faults in the buildings of the house. I mean, it would increase mitigation costs because someone would have to watch the videotape to verify that over the course of the 3 months he didn't make any other undiscovered damages, but it would be a way to defend himself against super compensatory damages.
Okay, so I think that what you're saying by the video camera hypothetical is that there is a way, or there could be a way in some circumstances, to eliminate one of the key features of our example, and that is the imperfect enforcement of something else feature. So if you add the video camera and we observe everything, and we can therefore punish each one of those other breaches, then there is no reason to award super compensatory damages on any one of them in particular. So is that what you're getting at?
Yes.
Okay, so
whether it's similar to the function of determining the high integrity contractor and the low integrity?
So I'm not sure. I think the relationship that I would draw, the connection that I would draw would be, this is what I thought you were getting at the beginning, is that we might get excessive care, precautions. And that's true, and as Dick Krasel pointed out to us, our example, since it only has L and H, these two levels, we don't see the over-deterrence possibility. And it is a real risk when we're talking about these categories of inadequate damages. If damages go too high, we can get over deterrence, and we should be mindful of that. But I think, aim here is a little bit less ambitious. It's simply, or more ambitious, depending on how you look at it. We want to show how super compensatory damages can be justified in this underlying notion of fault that is based on patterns, tying pattern to fault and super compensatory damages without going into the very important details of how to calculate the damages.
Yeah. I think that they should make a distinction between two situations. One situation, and it seems to me that your examples do not make this distinction. One situation is a situation in which there is a contract and all the breaches that you know, the pattern is with respect to the same aggrieved party. And another case in which, you know, there are many contracts, and they're probably writing, for example, the toaster, for example. Somebody sold me a toaster, and there is something there, a breach, that shows a pattern that probably damaged other people, not me. But as opposed to the example of the specification, you know, the Jacob and Young and others, in which it's my contract, and probably all the, you know, the pattern of breaches, undetectable breaches were all directed towards me. Now, these are two different situations.
Right.
And I think that this is an important distinction here, because first of all, I think that courts may, right, as a matter of whether to implement your argument, I think it would make a difference, mm-hmm. right? Because in one situation, it's the same party, and that's one thing, while in other cases, it's really like those punitive damages that some courts would not like. But I mean, one party gets super compensatory damages because other parties suffered losses. It's different. And I also think that I'm not sure that commissees would like to have these super compensatory damages in the second case, right? In the case in which, right, I mean, I would prefer to get, but I don't want to get super compensatory damages because you breached the contract with others, as long as I have to pay in advance for that. So I think that this is a distinction that could be.
That's right. So I think it is an important distinction, this colleague should talk more about. There is, of course, the basic element is shared by both classes of cases in this example. So we learn from one breach about other breaches. But in terms of the considerations that you mentioned, I think there's...
I want to say something about this. You know, what matters is the technology of the underlying investment. Some investments affect performance vis-a-vis many clients. Other investments, like in a construction project, make per client. What we're trying to infer is information about this investment. So it doesn't really matter what kind of case it is. I'm not sure that.
Maybe promises would just not want it. Right? I mean, if I know that all the breaches are towards me, probably I would prefer to get these super compensatory damages because, in fact, it's not super compensatory.
Take the insurance situation where the insurance company, you know, has a particular policy that applies to everyone.
Right.
Every insurance within this model of investment would want the insurance company to make the optimal investment in kind of monitoring claims and underwriting claims and payout claims. Whether or not they end up being, you know, they're willing to pay for more investment as long as it is the kind of investment that is. They get the benefit from it. So I'm not sure that whether the investment cuts across many cases, which matters for the.
But I'm saying, I would like actually to free ride on investments, right? I mean, if the insurance company need to invest and then it would affect 100 people, actually, I would prefer to free ride on the others. So I would say, I don't want to pay for the extra, for the super compensatory damages.
Okay, well, as inconvenient as it is, I guess this is where we have to break for our next paper.
This audio file is a production of the University of Chicago Law School. Visit us on the web at www.law.uchicago.edu.